route, it became apparent to the crew that it was going to be difficult to get André to any of these exterior sets, since his size prevented him from fitting in the transpo van, and his health precluded him from walking to and from the many steep, mountainous locations we were using. Therefore, production decided to rent him an all-terrain vehicle. Somehow they found one big enough to accommodate him, and he just loved it. I'll never forget the image of André darting around on his ATV, laughing loudly, the already noisy machine groaning from the weight of him. It was a sight to behold. He could bring the whole crew to a standstill. What really made it compelling was that he clearly had a great command of the vehicle and knew what he was doing.
"I have one just like it on my farm at home," he explained to me one day. "It's fun, boss. You should try it sometime."
For reasons related to both the acknowledged rules of professional conduct and general self-preservation, I politely declined. Actors in the midst of a movie production are expected to refrain from activity that might in any way jeopardize their ability to perform in the film. This includes a broad range of activities, from the merely stupid to the outright dangerous. Generally speaking, these things would normally be written into a contract, which is understandable, really. If you're a movie studio, investing millions of dollars in a movie, you have a right to expect that your star, again, unless you are Tom Cruise, will not go off bungee jumping, skydiving, parasailing, rock climbing, dune bugging, or ATV off-roading in the middle of production. Even though there may have been a clause in my contract stating as much, common sense dictated that I exercise prudence and caution when it came to these things. But André didn't give up.
"No, boss, really. It's easy. You'll like it."
I remember walking back from lunch to one of the transpo vans that would drive us all up the steep hill to begin shooting, and I noticed André sitting on his four-wheeler by the side of the road, chatting with Terry. As I neared the van, I heard that big, booming voice call out to me.
"Hey, boss, come here."
I sensed what was coming next, but I walked over anyway.
"You want to try my toy? Come on, you know you want to."
I don't know what came over me, what possible reason there might have been to throw caution and prudence to the wind, but suddenly I could hear these words escaping my lips. "Sure, why not?" Within a matter of seconds, I was sitting astride the great vehicular beast, which seemed significantly larger and more powerful up close than it had from a safe distance. I should have known better, not only for the aforementioned reasons, but also because I had no experience whatsoever on an ATV. Terry, who was responsible for shepherding the vehicle when André wasn't using it, gave me a quick tutorial.
"Clutch is right here," he said. "Put your foot on it like this."
He pressed down with his own foot, then released the clutch.
"Brakes are up here."
He then squeezed the brakes on the handlebars.
"It's just like a motorbike."
"Oh, okay, cool," I said, as he started up the engine. It was indeed loud, louder when you are actually on it. A big grin came over André's face. He was happy to see me about to venture off on my first ATV ride. I had no helmet or protective vest. In fact, I was armed with nothing but hubris. I released the clutch, and rather than easing slowly off the mark the way it had when André had driven it, the ATV lurched forward, practically throwing me from the saddle. I held on for dear life, like a rodeo cowboy leaving the stall on a bucking bronco. It must have been a comical sight to the bewildered crew watching me awkwardly try to master this four-wheeled bike. After a minute or so, I got my bearings and began to feel a bit more comfortable, so I foolishly decided to shift gears. As I applied the gas, the vehicle bounced over a thick patch of rocks, and my foot slipped from the clutch and became wedged between the pedal and one of the rocks, which caused the engine to sputter and stall. I looked down to see that the big toe on my left foot was bent straight downward. If this sounds painful, believe me, it was. I let the pain wash over me in excruciating waves. I can still feel it to this day as I remember it. It's an odd and no doubt particularly male reaction to feign indifference when confronted with an injury in a public setting, especially when that injury is the byproduct of one's own foolish behavior. I looked back to see Terry rushing toward me, along with several concerned members of the crew. As they drew near, I held up a hand and tried to smile through the pain. Yeah, I'm fine. It's all good. But I was merely trying to put on a brave front. Kind of like the Black Knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail proclaiming, "It's only a flesh wound," after having his legs hacked off. In reality, the throbbing in my foot was starting to build in intensity. But the initial pain and shock quickly gave way to sheer panic. This was a major shooting day for me, one where I would have to do a lot of walking around, even running. Not to mention the daily fencing practice. How the heck was I going to fake that? I was so scared and nervous, not only that I'd probably get a serious talking to from Rob for being so stupid and irresponsible, but maybe I'd even be replaced. After all, how could I sword fight if I could barely even walk? So out of utter fear, I did the dumbest thing I could have done. I pleaded with those present not to say anything. "I'll be fine," I said. "Don't worry." They could clearly see that I was not. A medic was summoned, and fortunately for me, like most medics, she was also a trained nurse. She carefully removed my black suede boot and sock, an enormously painful process in itself, and then tenderly studied my swollen big toe, which was pointing at an odd angle.
"Does that hurt?"
she said, touching it gently. I winced, clenching my teeth. "A little." Meanwhile, my toe was sending my brain messages like, "Scratch that a lot, dummy."
"Well, it's definitely broken," she said. "You should probably go to the hospital and get it x-rayed."
"Oh, no, I can't do that," I said, sounding more fearful than courageous. "And not right now. We have a scene to shoot. It'll be okay. We can do it after we wrap." She looked at me as if I were crazy. Maybe this guy hit his head as well. Fear had definitely clouded my judgment. I wasn't thinking rationally. I knew exactly what the shooting schedule entailed. I knew the way Rob liked to work. By now, I had hit my stride with him, on most occasions printing my first takes and moving on to the next setup. I knew that we would be in this location only for this one day, and that if I were unable to shoot what we needed to get, we'd have to come back at a later date to complete it. Meaning they would have to postpone my scenes and basically change the whole schedule while I got checked out and treated. I also knew that the doctors would most likely suggest that I shouldn't walk on it for a few days, perhaps even a few weeks, while my toe was put in a cast or a splint and allowed to heal properly. The whole thing would cost time and money, and that would all be on me. All these thoughts and more were running through my head at that moment. I knew actors had been fired for less egregious lapses in wisdom. Even though he is not the freaking out type, I envisioned Rob questioning whether I was worth the trouble I had caused. I'd be done. That would be it, I thought. They'd have to find another Wesley. It would then hit the press and my career would be over. After all, who could blame them? It was all my fault. I was the cretin who didn't have the sense to stay off an ATV in the middle of production. Why waste any more time on me? You see, it's one thing to get hurt while shooting a scene. If you get injured while filming, then everyone understands and feels bad for you. "Tough break, man. Don't sweat it. Go home and rest and then come back when you're all better." Bond companies have insurance policies that cover these kinds of things, so the producers don't have to worry. But if, on the other hand, you injure yourself fooling around off the set, that's a whole other kettle of fish. Sure, accidents happen, but this was an accident that could totally have been avoided. I had brought it on myself by messing around with a toy that, in hindsight, I realize wasn't really a toy. It is a dangerous machine, a machine I obviously did not know how to operate and had no business even trying to operate. There was a lot at stake here. Jobs, money, insurance issues. It was a potential disaster. Foolishly, rather than coming clean, I chose to hide it. In other words, I tried to get away with it. "Please," I said to the medic and the genuinely concerned crew members standing around, "don't tell Rob. I'm going to be okay." I remember Terry saying, "I think he's going to find out, mate. I mean, your toe is broken." I turned to the medic. I was desperate at this point and starting to sweat profusely. "Is there anything you can do?" I pleaded. She gently cupped my foot in the palm of her hand.
"I suppose I could do a temporary splint."
"Really? Will it work? I asked hopefully. She explained that there isn't much else you can do for a busted toe. It was probably what the doctors would end up doing anyway, since toes are too small to put in a cast. She said they would most likely also recommend a lot of rest and ice. But if movement is necessary, a small splint could possibly be utilized, even though not highly recommended.
Do they have to do that at the hospital, or can you do it right here?
I asked, trying to mask the panic in my voice. She nodded.
I think I can do it here, but it's still going to hurt. I mean, in other words, it's still going to feel like you have a broken toe,
she said, trying to reason with an unreasonable person.
Great, I said. Can you please try?
Naive as I was at the time, I didn't realize that by asking her to do this for me, I was probably putting this poor woman's job on the line, as well as all those present, by asking them not to say anything. I didn't even realize that she would have to make out a medical report, and that would have to go to production anyway. But I wasn't thinking properly. I was willing to try anything at this point. Like most Brits, I came from that stoic background of the whole "the show must go on" thing. In other words, I was willing to do whatever was necessary to get the show back on the road. The medic opened her large first aid bag and began crafting a makeshift splint. Meanwhile, one of the ADs had shown up with a walkie-talkie to find out what all the fuss was about and, more important, to bring me to the set. I tried to enlist him not to say anything as well, as if that was going to work with a man with a walkie-talkie whose job I knew very well was to report any reason for delays to the first AD. I was so blinded by fear, I was involving all these poor people in my half-witted conspiracy to keep the very person who needed to know the truth from knowing it. Now we had another issue. My foot wouldn't fit back in the boot. Great. So we summoned a wardrobe assistant and asked her for help.
I need a favor, I said. Can you cut a hole in the back of the boot in such a way that it won't show on camera?
By now, an even larger crowd had begun to gather around. Had I been thinking properly, I would have known obviously that, with this many people watching, word would eventually get back to Rob. But, like a soccer player trying to hide an injury, I was focused only on one thing, getting back onto the field. I even began trying to fool myself that it was going to work. Here was my insane logic. With the splint anchoring my damaged toe and my sock covering the splint, it would be fine. The sock was also black. That way, if the camera were to pick up the hole in the boot, the glaring white bandage holding the splint in place wouldn't show up. It might just work. What a buffoon. My toe, however, wasn't having any of it. It was still sending my brain more messages, nagging things like, "Really, dude?" and "Are you serious?" Eventually, I was able to stuff my poor, swollen mess of a foot into the modified boot. The maneuver itself was insanely painful. But I had deluded myself that once it was on, and I was back on my feet, everything would be okay. Clearly, I figured wrong. As soon as I tried to take a step, it was apparent that even through my toughest grit, I wasn't fooling anyone, least of all myself. I wasn't going to be able to walk without a limp, let alone run or fight a sword fight. I'll just have to fake my way through it, I thought. The AD helped me limp over to the transport van, and I was then driven up the long ravine to the set. It was perhaps the longest drive I have ever taken. Everyone in the van was silent. They were probably thinking, "This deluded actor is out of his mind, poor sod." As soon as we arrived, I put on the bravest face I could muster, hopped as best I could out of the van, and walked right over to Rob like nothing was wrong, just eating the pain the whole way.
"Hey, Carrie, how you doing, buddy?" he said with a big smile.
I froze for a nanosecond. Had someone already told him? Could this possibly be my last day on the movie? Oh, please don't let it be so. "Good, thanks," I replied, praying that my face, which I was unaware was already sweating, didn't betray the strain.
"Everything okay? No problems? You feeling good?"
"Yeah, absolutely." My brain received another toe message. "Hello, anybody home?" He smiled in that way that only Rob could smile. It was a big, closed-mouthed one.
"So, when were you going to tell me?"
Tell you what? I stammered, giving possibly the single worst performance of my career. He just kept on smiling. I could tell he wasn't buying it. I think he even nodded a bit, the kind of nod that says, uh-huh. Finally, I couldn't keep up the pretense any longer. I'm so sorry, Rob. I don't know what I was thinking. He looked deep into my eyes and then spoke.
Don't worry about it, Carrie, he replied. But you gotta know, you can tell me these things, all right? We're all in this together.
He seemed hurt that I would try to lie to him, and he was right to. I felt like such a numbnut. I tried to explain the reason behind my secrecy, that I was embarrassed, but also worried that he'd be forced to shut down production, or perhaps worse. I thought you might actually let me go. He seemed almost more hurt by that remark.
Are you crazy? Why would I do that? You're perfect for this role.
I don't know. I feel like a complete twit. Please forgive me.
Don't sweat it.
He then looked down at my hopelessly and obviously makeshift boot.
Can you walk?
Yeah.
Can you run?
I don't know. I haven't really tried yet, but I'll certainly give it my best shot.
Okay, well, we'll just have to film around it if need be. Just don't be afraid to tell me anything. I'd be more upset if you didn't, okay?
I nodded sheepishly. Okay. He hugged me, and I felt his genuine love and support. What a mensch. I couldn't believe I'd been so dumb as to try and hide it from him. But when you're young, sometimes you do dumb things, like trying to show off your lack of skill on an all-terrain vehicle to a slightly bemused crew. I learned a couple of valuable lessons that day, ones I've carried with me throughout my life and career. First of all, never try out a new sport on a film set unless the part calls for it and you are properly supervised. I will certainly never set foot on an ATV again, that's for sure. Second, always be open and honest, not only with your director, but with everyone. The truth is always easier. The fact is, not every director might have been as cool as Rob was about it. When we finished shooting for the day, we had another talk, one in which Rob made it clear that while he wasn't angry with me, he wanted to make sure that I understood the ramifications of my actions. It was a fatherly pep talk about responsibility and prudence. I was in practically every scene of the movie, he explained. We still had extensive and complicated sword-fighting sequences to shoot. There was a lot riding on my health and viability. Looking back, I think that was justifiably his biggest concern, that my foot wouldn't heal in time to film the duel. Don't forget, we had committed to staging it without doubles. In many cases, you can work around an injured actor, but when it came time for Wesley to square off against Inigo, it had to be just Mandy and me, and we both were expected to be at our best. I appreciate it, Rob, I said. I'll be ready then, I promise.
Okay, good. Your health is always more important than a movie, always, Rob said. You should know that. But we need to know what's going on at all times.
The truth was somewhat murkier, however. I really had no idea whether my toe would heal in time or not. All I knew was that, at that instant, I was filled with enormous regret and embarrassment, and that my toe hurt really bad. Immediately after wrap, I was taken straight to the local hospital to get a proper x-ray done and a full examination, the results of which echoed the medic's preliminary assessment. I had indeed broken my left big toe, which had been bent completely downward when it was sandwiched between the clutch pedal and the rock. The doctor at the hospital removed the makeshift splint and applied a newer, smaller one. It would smart for a while, he said, but there wasn't much that could be done to accelerate the healing process. The best course of treatment was to stay off my feet. Here was a doctor telling a grown man dressed as Zorro to stay off his feet. Oh boy. Best case scenario was that, even though it would still hurt, I might be able to at least move about relatively free of limping in approximately 2 to 3 weeks. I knew the schedule pretty well by this point. The sword fight wasn't scheduled until November, so I figured I had time to heal and get ready for the most physical part of the film. Up until that point, I'd just have to fake any scenes involving running or jumping, and rely on the magic of cinema to mask the severity of my injury. But I'd be lying if I said I wasn't still completely racked with guilt and anxiety over the whole thing. We were 6 weeks into production, deep, but not so deep that I felt I couldn't or wouldn't still be replaced, Rob's declaration to the contrary notwithstanding. Over the next couple of days, we had to figure out how to execute the reveal scene between Wesley and Buttercup, despite the fact that I was hobbled by a broken toe. Not quite Misery-style hobbled, thank goodness, but hobbled enough. In true Hollywood fashion, much of this was accomplished with smoke and mirrors, as they say. We shot our scene on top of the hill, with a man in black taunting Buttercup about her love for Wesley, then the sequence of both of them rolling down the hill, with Wesley yelling, "As you wish," which I did in post. A shot that thankfully had always been planned with our stunt doubles, Andy and Sue. Robin and I then took our places at the bottom of the ravine, where Buttercup and Wesley are reunited, apparently no worse for wear, after careening several hundred meters down a steep hillside packed with rocks and other obstacles. It should be pointed out that by this point, the man in black is no longer the man in black, as his mask has fallen off. He is once again Wesley. "Can you move?" asked Wesley. An interesting question, since I could barely move myself. "Move? You're alive. If you want, I can fly," replies Buttercup. During this sequence, if you look closely, you can see that my leg is positioned oddly just prior to the moment when Wesley crawls toward Buttercup. That is no accident. That is me trying to find a comfortable position for my poor, very swollen foot.
Rob Reiner. I only found out Carrie broke his toe because somebody had told me. You're gonna see Carrie can't walk too good. He was limping around, obviously in pain, but it didn't bother his performance. I mean, he didn't have to do anything physical at that time, but if you look closely at the film, when he's on top of the mountain with Robin, before she pushes him down the hill, they have this scene and he sits down and he's leaning up against this log. And you can see the way he sits down with his leg extended. He didn't want to put any weight on it. And when he did it, I thought, wow, what an elegant way to sit down. I didn't realize that he just couldn't put any weight on his foot.
Andy Scheinman.
It's so funny because now every time I see that scene, it's hysterical. All Carrie is doing is basically trying to protect a broken toe. The first time I saw it, I just thought, wow, what a cool move. But now, when I watch it today, all I can think about is Carrie having a sore toe, not anything about the scene. Those are the things you remember when you make a movie.
Moments later, Wesley and Buttercup scramble to their feet and race toward the fire swamp, in the apparently suicidal hope of eluding Prince Humperdinck's soldiers. Again, if you look closely, you can clearly see that my character has a noticeable hop in his step. My apologies for that. I did the best I could to hide it, but a strange skip was all I could manage. Fortunately, since Robin and I were supposed to run together while holding hands, I convinced myself that it looked appropriately awkward. Fleeing, after all, is rarely a graceful exercise. And neither is fencing, unfortunately, when you can barely walk. Nevertheless, I was allowed only a small reprieve from training. Peter and Bob came to see me the morning after my injury, asked how I was feeling, but expressed only a little bit of sympathy, which, to be honest, was about all I deserved. They then suggested that we get back to training the very next day, which we did. There was absolutely no messing around with these guys. They were concerned enough as it was about not having enough time to train Mandy and me adequately to meet the demands of the screenplay and the schedule. If we couldn't convincingly portray two men capable of staging an epic sword fight, then they would bear some of the responsibility. Failure was not a word in their vocabulary, neither was excuse. "Can you move your arms?" Bob asked me. "Yes." "Good, then you can train. Don't worry about your footwork," he said. "We'll just rehearse from the waist up. The arm movements are the key anyway. In the end, that's what the audience is going to be watching." So, for the next couple of weeks, I trained while standing in place, going through the entire fight sequence without moving my feet, or by moving very slowly and carefully. It actually proved to be an effective method, almost like cross-training. By focusing only on the arm movements, I developed a deeper understanding of the sword choreography involved in the fight. I guess you could say it was an unplanned benefit. A lesser injury occurred about a month later in Burnham Beeches Forest in Buckinghamshire, not long after the pain in my foot had finally begun to subside a little. We were filming the scene in which Buttercup and Wesley having survived the fire swamp, find themselves exhausted, filthy, and ambushed by Humperdinck, Rugen, and a bunch of crossbow-toting Florinese soldiers. When it becomes apparent that there is no chance of escape, Buttercup barters for Wesley's freedom by agreeing to return with Humperdinck and become his bride, an acquiescence that surprises both the prince and Wesley. Humperdinck agrees, albeit duplicitously, as he has no intention of following through on his end of the bargain. Before riding off with Buttercup, he says quietly to Count Rugen, "Once we're out of sight, take him back to Florin and throw him in the pit of despair." As drawn by Goldman and played marvelously by Chris Guest, Rugen is a deliciously malevolent character, with an evil glint in his eye and an Inquisition-style zest for doling out pain and punishment. A menacing figure indeed, and the glee with which he accepts Humperdinck's orders is both humorous and hateful as he repeats the prince's fake oath to Buttercup to return Wesley to his ship back to him. "I swear it will be done." Moments after Humperdinck leaves with Buttercup, Wesley notices the strange glove worn by Rugen. "You have 6 fingers on your right hand," Wesley says. "Someone was looking for you. He was..." But before he can finish his sentence, Rugen cuts him off by hitting him over the head with the butt of his sword, knocking him unconscious. I know I have said this about everyone in the cast, but it's true. Chris Guest is one of the nicest people you will ever meet. He is also one of the funniest. You only have to look at his body of work before and after The Princess Bride to know that. This is Spinal Tap, Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, and For Your Consideration, to name but a few. For me, all I have to do is look at his face and I crack up. The man is a comic genius, which only made his portrayal of Count Tyrone Rugen even more impressive. Of all the actors who performed in The Princess Bride, I would say Chris is the one who had the least in common with his character. Ironically, given that he is such a great comedian, Chris only has one funny line in the whole movie when he says to Humperdinck, "Get some rest. If you haven't got your health, you haven't got anything." For the most part, Rugen is a sadist. Chris, however, wouldn't hurt a fly, gentle fellow that he is. So when it came to doing this particular stunt, he was concerned about even touching me with the sword. That's because his sword was a real sword. There was no rubber double on hand to use for the stunt. It was an actual metal weapon, dense and heavy. As a result, during the first couple of takes, it was obvious that Chris was holding back. I could barely feel the handle tapping my skull, which made it difficult to react appropriately. We tried it a few times, but our camera operator, Sean O'Dell, told Rob that he could see that the sword was not touching my head and that I was reacting either too soon or too late. That's when I made a fatal error in judgment by opening my big mouth with a silly suggestion, one that I would come to regret.
Christopher Guest.
Movie stunts involving contact with weapons or fists require a certain technical way of shooting them. Like when Mandy slashed his sword across my face in our duel, and depending on the camera angle, we could fake that because when we were shooting over my shoulder onto him, you could see the sword coming toward the camera. But when we shot the reverse, the sword was actually nowhere near my face, even though it looked like it because of the specific angle. It's a trick, basically. It's like when people punch each other in the movies, when you actually have the actor turn away from the camera, which helps sell it. This was quite different because there was no way to do that in this case. There was nowhere for Carrie to actually turn, given that the butt end of the sword was coming straight down on his head.
"You know what, Chris," I said, "why don't you just go ahead and give me a slight tap on the head? Just hard enough that I'll get the feeling, and then I think the timing will work." Understandably, Chris was initially reluctant, as was Peter Diamond, who was on hand to coordinate the stunt. Eventually, though, it was decided after a couple of rehearsals that he could put a little force behind the blow, just enough to help me sell it. So we started to roll.
"Turn over. Sound speed. 140 take 5.
Clap, went the clapperboard.
And action, yelled Rob.
Chris swung the heavy sword down toward my head. However, as fate would have it, it landed just a touch harder than either of us anticipated, and that, folks, was the last thing I remember from that day's shoot. In the script, Bill's stage directions from the end of the scene state, "The screen goes black. In the darkness, frightening sounds." Which is precisely what happened. I woke up in the emergency room, still in costume, to the frightening sound of stitches being sewn into my skull. From the same doctor, no less, who had treated me only a few weeks earlier for my broken toe. I remember him saying to me after I came to, "Well, Zorro, you seem to be a little accident prone, don't you?" And of course, Chris felt absolutely terrible about the whole thing, even though I kept telling him it wasn't his fault. It was my dumb idea.
Christopher Guest.
Carrie was hurt. I cut his head, I believe, with the bottom of the sword. I'm not sure if it was a real sword or not. It might have been a real sword, but the handles were definitely real in any case, even if the blades weren't. Basically, I just came down and actually hit him.
But you know what? That particular take was the one that ended up in the film. So when you see Wesley fall to the ground and pass out, that's not acting. That's an overzealous actor actually losing consciousness. The next day on the set, the cast and crew went out of their way to make sure I was okay. I'm not sure whether I was admired for suffering from my art or looked upon as a bit of a nut, given that I had actually asked another actor to hit me with a real medieval sword. I do know that I already felt like I had become part of a rather large and diverse family, if a bit of a clumsy, accident-prone addition. On the 26th of October, 1986, we shot part of the sequence where the man in black climbs up the fake cliffs of insanity back on C stage at Shepperton. After we wrapped, I headed to my dressing room and went about the process of changing from Wesley back into Carrie. I washed my face, dressed back into my regular clothes, packed up my script bag, and got ready to head home. I usually like to listen to music when I unwind from a day's work, and after Rob told me that Mark Knopfler had agreed to score the movie, I began listening to Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits, which had come out only the year before. I recall becoming hooked on the album all over again, and on the title track in particular. Rob told me that Knopfler had only one request before agreeing to do the film, that Rob had to find a way to place Marty DeBerge's USS Coral Sea baseball cap that he wore in Spinal Tap somewhere in the movie. Clearly, Tom Petty and Sting weren't the only rock stars who had a special place in their hearts for the mockumentary. For those of you who have never spotted it, the hat can be seen on a shelf in Fred Savage's bedroom. According to the liner notes on the Princess Bride album, Knopfler stated that he was only kidding about the hat, but Rob is the kind of guy who loves a challenge, especially if it's a fun one.
Rob Reiner.
I had a good friend named Bobby Columbia, a record producer and a really cool guy who used to be the drummer for Blood, Sweat, and Tears. So I told him, I want to get a different take on this, you know? I want a traditional score, but I also want it to have a modern feel to it, too. And it was he who suggested Mark Knopfler. I knew Mark had done the score for Local Heroes, so I said, geez, that would be great because he has such a distinctive guitar sound. Mark said he would only do it if I put the cap I wore in Spinal Tap somewhere in the set. So if you look closely in the scenes where Peter Falk is reading the book, you'll see it in the background.
Just as I was leaving my dressing room in my regular clothes after switching off the tape deck, this was the 80s after all, one of the assistant directors came running up to me.
"Oh, Carrie, sorry," he said out of breath. "They need you back on the set."
"Oh, I thought I was wrapped."
"They need to get one more shot, and they need to do it quickly. Can you get dressed again?"
"Okay, but just let them know it's going to take a little while," I said, "as I'll need to put makeup on again." The AD continued breathlessly. "Rob said not to worry about that. It's a wide shot, so no one will notice. They just need you in your costume." This sounded a bit strange, but not unusual. On a film, it is rare, but not out of the ordinary, to be called back to the set if the director suddenly realizes he needs another shot, even after you've returned to your hotel sometimes. So I went into my dressing room, put my costume back on, grabbed my mask, sword, and gloves, and headed back with the AD to the soundstage. As I walked onto the set, the first thing I noticed was a distinct lack of movement. Everyone was just milling about. They weren't working. They were just standing there, as if waiting for something to happen. Then, everyone turned to face me, revealing what they had actually been hiding, a large cake with a man in black crafted in icing and lit candles. They all smiled and yelled, "Surprise!" And then they sang Happy Birthday to me. I swear I had forgotten it was my birthday. I stood there silently, taking it all in. For a moment I thought I might cry. I was so moved as they sang. Instead, I just laughed. I had just turned 24 and was in the final month of possibly the most important job of my career. I couldn't have felt happier or more at home. Chapter 11. The Greatest Sword Fight in Modern Times. I am often asked what my favorite scene is in the movie, but it's difficult to pick just one, as that would mean weighing the importance of one scene against another, or declaring one moment in the film to be of greater significance or achievement than the rest. And the truth is, I enjoyed the whole process. Certainly, from the very beginning of pre-production, it had been made clear to all of us, and to Mandy and me in particular, that the elegant sword fight between us would be among the highlights of the film. Moreover, that we were going to strive, at least, for something akin to movie legend. And indeed, there it was, written exactly that way in Goldman's screenplay, all capital letters, boldface type, and underlined twice, lest there be any doubt. Quite a thing to live up to. Whether we'd fall short of that goal was largely up to both of us, and the degree to which we were willing to train and study under Bob and Peter. It should also be noted that Chris Guest had to train and rehearse as well for Rugen's final encounter with Inigo. And even though that fight is much shorter and more one-sided, and perhaps the training less intense for Chris, it still meant double the training for Mandy. Chris said that Mandy appeared really pumped up during rehearsal, and that he'd actually stuck him with his sword by mistake. After this accident, Chris apparently told Peter that he was going to throw out everything they had learned and was basically going to try to just defend himself once the cameras started rolling.
Christopher Guest.
It took a lot of work for people who had never done that, and I had never done it, so it took a long time to prepare. We trained with these carbon fiber blades because they're lighter. You don't use real metal swords because they're too heavy. And then they put in the sound later. In rehearsal with Mandy, I actually got stuck in the thigh. The point went right into my leg, and I thought, oh, well, that hurts. After that, I approached it where I was basically actually defending myself. It's a strange thing. We had our sword fight in this 11th century castle, and it was really like a kid's dream to be in a costume, having a sword fight in a place where they probably had a sword fight 500 years ago. And I was making the sounds when we were fighting, the sounds that the swords would make as you would when you were a kid. Ch, 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 ch. And Rob yelled, "Cut." And I said, "What? What's going on?" And he said, "Chris, we'll put in the sounds later." Well, that got a huge laugh and the place just exploded, but it would be the perfect sort of thing a kid would do.
As for Mandy and me, through basic training and the first couple of months of shooting, we felt reasonably confident about the progress we were making, despite my now injured toe. We had put in the time. That was never an issue. Bob and Peter made certain of that, filling every free second with practice. Our job was to put some meat on the bones of the fight, to create a duel whose physicality would match the brilliance of the words that accompanied it. In mid-October, we got our first review while I was filming a scene with the great and greatly underrated Mel Smith. For those of you who don't recall, Mel played the gleeful albino who preps Wesley for his torture session in the pit of despair. I'd be remiss if I didn't say a few words about Mel, who was another one of my favorite comedians growing up and has since sadly passed away. In the early to mid-1980s, Mel, his writing partner Griff Rhys-Jones, and Rowan Atkinson all starred together in a fantastically funny and popular British sketch comedy show called Not the 9 o'clock News. He was a wonderful improvisational actor and comedian, and, like Billy, clearly grasped the opportunity to embellish the small role and turn it into something memorable. Even though he didn't look anything like the character, it was a perfect bit of casting, with his white wig, bloodshot eyes, massive cold sore, and a delightfully fey manner seemingly at odds with the awful work he was about to perform, he truly embodied the albino. And when I heard he would be joining the cast, I was thrilled. "We got Mel Smith," I remember saying to Rob. You're kidding. That's great. I think Chris Guest, being the incredible connoisseur of comedy that he is, was the only other cast member who actually knew who Mel was.
Christopher Guest.
What's unusual about this film is that so many people had great turns to do. You look at the richness of these parts, and virtually everyone gets to do something that's memorable in the movie. That's very unusual, and it speaks to the strength of the script and a way of approaching a movie where if all the parts are good and they're done well, it's going to be so much better than just having two stars and weaker supporting roles. That's a disaster, and it takes the whole thing down, and it happens a lot, unfortunately.
It took all day to film The Pit of Despair because, as with the scenes involving Billy, I found it challenging to maintain my composure. There's something inherently ridiculous about lying on your back, with suction cups attached to your nipples, staring up at Chris Guest and Mel Smith, pretending to endure searing pain while strapped to a massive life-sucking machine. I remember both Rob and I lost it on the first take when Mel unexpectedly did that whole bit on the steps where he loses his balance. Then the whole coughing and hacking bit? Forget it. In the end, I think I had to turn away during his off-camera dialogue, just because I couldn't look at his face without laughing. Since Inigo's character was not needed for the Pit of Despair scene, Mandy had spent much of the morning training with Bob and Peter between setups. At lunchtime, we wandered over to the set for the Cliffs of Insanity, where the sword fight would take place, so that we could give Rob and Andy a demonstration. After a few moments of stretching and some last-minute notes from Bob and Peter, Mandy and I began the duel for the small crowd that had gathered, including some of the department heads and producers. I thought it went rather well, and when we were finally done, Mandy and I, both covered with sweat, received a very gracious applause from everyone in attendance. I remember standing there with my sword at my side, my chest still heaving from the effort. Everyone seemed pleased, including Bob and Peter. Rob, however, had a look not of dissatisfaction, but certainly not one of complete approval either. His expression was kind of blank. Scratching his beard, he walked over to us, deep in thought. He then looked up at us and asked,
"That's it?"
I looked at Mandy. He looked at me. We both looked at Bob and Peter. There was a long beat before I responded, "Yeah, that's it." Not exactly the response we had anticipated, as I'm sure you would agree. Mandy and I had spent so many hours practicing and perfecting the duel, mapping out each and every step of the choreography, every thrust and parry of the fight, that we were now able to perform it not only fluidly, but flawlessly, without even thinking about it. We figured that was the goal, and it was, to a point. There was one thing we hadn't considered, though. By mastering the sequence, we had also shortened it. A duel that once lasted 4 to 5 minutes back in August had now become considerably faster.
"How long was that?"
Rob asked our script supervisor, Kerry Evans. Kerry approached with a stopwatch. 1 minute 23 seconds, she reported. Rob shook his head solemnly.
"Not long enough. This is supposed to be the greatest sword fight in modern times, but it's over too quickly."
"What do we do?" I asked. Rob shrugged.
"Go back and add some more. Look at this beautiful set. We spent all this money. We built it for you guys. We can't be in here for just a minute."
Bob Anderson explained to him that we had pretty much used every part of the set, and that if we added more, we would just be going over the same terrain. Rob then turned to Norman Garwood, who was standing nearby.
"Norman, is there any way you could build up the ruins of a tower over there with some steps? Then maybe these guys could go up the steps and play around up there. And then we could bring it all the way back down here on the level ground for the finish."
He paused. Norman nodded. "Yeah, I think so," he said. Nothing was ever too much trouble for Norman.
"Great," Rob turned back to us. "You guys go back and make it longer and better. We need at least 3 minutes, okay?"
Bob, Peter, Mandy, and I all nodded like school kids who got a decent passing grade from our professor, but wanted the highest score possible. As a team, we were shooting for 11 out of 10, like Nigel Tufnell's amp. At a subsequent meeting with Peter, Bob, and Mandy, I threw out the suggestion that we collect every single swashbuckling movie available on video, including the ones we had already watched, and watch them again to find out what we needed. Movies like The Crimson Pirate, The Mark of Zorro, Captain Blood, The Black Pirate, Adventures of Don Juan, The Count of Monte Cristo, The Three Musketeers, The Scarlet Pimpernel, The Seahawk, The Prisoner of Zenda, Scaramouche, etc. And we did. We would fast forward to the fight scenes and study them in detail to see if we could spot anything we could borrow or improve on. We discovered that Scaramouche, starring Stuart Granger and Mel Ferrer, featured the longest, most intricate movie sword fight in cinema history. So our rallying cry became, "Let's beat Scaramouche!" Not the time, certainly. The movie's duel clocked in at 6 minutes, and we knew we couldn't beat that. But we did want to at least try to beat it in terms of being memorable. In order to do that, we added all kinds of extra things, like going up the steps of the castle ruin, as Rob suggested, and almost pushing over a big rock. And then we agreed that we could add a bit of acrobatics, where we throw our swords in the ground, spin off a high bar, and dismount perfectly. Obviously, that would involve the use of a stunt double, who turned out to be an accomplished gymnast named Jeff Davis. And since that particular stunt did not actually involve sword fighting, it seemed like fair game. Originally, Jeff was going to do the same swing for Wesley as he did for Inigo. I asked him if he could do a double for my character. Rob loved the idea, and Jeff performed it immaculately on every take. We also added a piece where Mandy and I leap up onto some rocks with the use of a small trampoline, and a somersault for Inigo as he leaps over my head, also performed by Jeff. And a bit where Mandy would lose his sword for a moment, then catch it midair. I'm probably making this sound less stressful than it actually was. The fact is, the moment Rob said, "That's it," I think I can speak for Mandy too when I say we became just a tad anxious. We had spent nearly 3 months choreographing one of the biggest scenes in the movie, and now, roughly a few weeks before we were due to shoot it, we had to go back to the drawing board and add 2 minutes or so. Pretty scary stuff. We'd been filming and training 5 days a week up to that point, but Bob and Peter now declared that Saturday would no longer be a day off. "Sorry, boys," I remember Bob saying. "We have to get this right, and we have even less time to do it in." So Mandy and I continued to practice and practice until we had carefully plotted out a sequence that would last approximately 3 minutes total, as per our director's instructions. It was a little harder for me, as my left foot was still tender, but eventually we felt we had it down cold. By the time Bob and Peter were finally happy with it, we were ready to put it on film.
Wallace Shawn.
The sword fights took immense discipline and work, and they really did it. I have to say, I was impressed.
We began shooting the scene at 8:30 a.m. on Monday, November 10th, on C Stage at Shepperton, which had now been marvelously transformed to look like a castle ruin at the top of the Cliffs of Insanity. I had a lot of fun days while filming The Princess Bride, but this, for me, was possibly the most memorable. You could feel the magic on the set. There was a palpable sense of excitement and healthy tension. While Mandy and I warmed up and reviewed the basic choreography with Bob and Peter, the set started getting packed with onlookers. Typically, only the personnel required for a given scene are allowed to watch, but now it seemed that everyone wanted to see us film the sword fight. I swear I saw the studio valet parking guy there, standing in the back with his arms folded, as if to say, "Entertain me." Even Bill Goldman flew back from New York to see it for himself, as if there weren't enough pressure. I'll admit to having some butterflies in my stomach. They were mostly the good variety, though, the kind you get when you're excited, not when you think of failing. In fact, I think Mandy and I were so well prepared for this moment, we actually couldn't wait to get started.
Rob Reiner.
Carrie and Mandy had to learn to fence both left-handed and right-handed, and we wanted to make sure that they could design a really cool fencing sequence. So, when we finally got to it, I was so proud of the fact that the two of them, I mean Mandy, had started working on it even before we went over to London. He was working on it, I think, for about 4 months, and Carrie worked for only about 2 months. I'm very proud of the fact that every single frame of actual sword fighting is both of them. There are no doubles except for the acrobatics when they flip over the bar. The actual swordplay, every single frame, is just the two of them, left-handed and right-handed. I will put that up against any sword fight in movie history.
Rob wanted to jump straight into the fight sequence itself and save the long conversation between Inigo and the man in black that precedes it, in which Inigo explains his obsession with hunting down the six-fingered man who killed his father, for later. We started with the simple lines. "You seem a decent fellow," Inigo says as the two men square off. "I hate to kill you." "You seem a decent fellow," the man in black replies. "I hate to die." If you look at it carefully, the choreography of the piece begins slowly at first, with the two masters testing each other, feeling each other out. Gradually, though, the duel escalates in tempo, speed, and intensity. "You are using Bonetti's defense against me," Inigo says, displaying both his knowledge of classic swordsmanship and an appreciation for his opponent. He already knows that this will be a chess match as well as a fight. "I thought it fitting," Wesley responds with a sly smile, considering the rocky terrain. The beauty of this sword fight, of course, is that it combines the execution of both physical mastery and brilliant dialogue. Goldman has Wesley and Inigo exchange gracious, complimentary remarks about their opponents' tactics and style, even as they try to vanquish one another. In my humble opinion, it has never been equaled, nor perhaps will it ever be. "You are wonderful," Inigo says at one point. "Thank you," Wesley politely replies. "I've worked hard to become so." Never a truer line had been spoken. And then comes the beautiful moment when Inigo reveals that he is, in fact, not left-handed and flips the sword into his stronger hand. "You are amazing," Wesley acknowledges as Inigo pins him against a crumbling rock ledge.
"I ought to be after 20 years," Inigo replies.
"There is one thing I must tell you," Wesley says.
"What is that?"
"I'm not left-handed either." With that, Wesley frees himself and causes Inigo to lose his sword. Inigo then uses a nearby and conveniently placed horizontal bar to perform an acrobatic escape maneuver. In pursuit, Wesley does him one better. After throwing his sword expertly so it will stick in the ground, he performs a double giant swing and perfect dismount, landing directly in front of the shocked but impressed Inigo.
"Who are you?" he says, legitimately curious.
"No one of consequence," the man in black responds.
"I must know," Inigo replies.
"Get used to disappointment," one of my favorite Goldman lines. Mandy then gave the most wonderful unscripted response to this line, a kind of mumbled, "Okay," with a little shrug, much like a Spaniard would do before returning to the duel. The fight continues until Wesley knocks Inigo's sword from his hand and holds his blade against the Spaniard's throat.
"Kill me quickly," Inigo demands proudly.
But Wesley has other plans. "I would as soon destroy a stained glass window as an artist like yourself. However, since I can't have you following me either." And with that, Wesley uses the butt of his sword to knock Inigo unconscious. After my mishap with Chris, it was decided this time that I should walk behind Mandy and swipe the back of his head without actually touching him. An easy sell for the camera, and no one would have to go to the hospital. "It's only a mistake if you don't learn from it," as my father used to say. We did the entire fight sequence from start to finish with Mandy and me, sans the acrobatics, of course, in a single take. Rob captured it on two cameras from different angles, and I'm proud to say we did not make a single mistake. When we finished, the entire crowd in attendance burst into applause. Bob and Peter were beaming. Goldman was speechless. Only my big toe remained unimpressed.
"Great job, guys," Rob said. "Fantastic. Now let's do it again."
And so we did. Over and over and over. 1 day became 2, 2 days became 3, 3 then became 4. In all, we ended up spending the better part of a week filming the greatest sword fight in modern times, which I suppose is appropriate. We shot from the front, from the back, wide angles, close-ups from my point of view, Mandy's point of view, etc. At one point, we even shot 17 takes from a single angle, all printed. After the 10th take, I remember Rob saying, "Very cool," in that voice of his. And then we did 7 more. I remember feeling a true kinship with Mandy that week. The truth is, While we certainly got along very well throughout the production, we really didn't get to spend a lot of time socializing on the set, as we spent most, if not all, of our spare time training. By the time we were done with that, and after a long day of shooting, all we wanted to do was go home and soak our weary limbs in a hot bath. During the shooting of the actual fight, however, I remember feeling very close to him, probably in much the same way that boxers might grow close to each other, despite being opponents.
Mandy Patinkin. Rob wanted the actors to be seen doing all the fencing. He wanted full body shots, as opposed to most other fencing pictures where it would be the point of view of the actors, where you would see only the hand of the other fencer off camera. In most movies, this would be done by a stunt double, but Rob was adamant that we do all the fighting ourselves. My greatest memory and pleasure in terms of fencing was the fact that we became proficient enough to improvise on a dime. I remember on one of the final days of shooting the sequence where we were going up the stairs, changing from the left to the right hand, it didn't quite work for the camera. And I remember turning to Bob Anderson, a beautiful man, God rest his soul, and he had a suggestion. I said, "Go tell Rob." And he said, "Oh no, that's not my place." I said, "Bob, he doesn't know anything about fencing. You're the guy. You've got to tell him." So Carrie and I went over with Bob and Peter, and we told him. And Rob took a moment and then said, "Okay, go ahead and fix it, but make it quick." We only had about 20 minutes, and we re-choreographed that whole sequence, which we had spent weeks choreographing within an inch of its life. We had learned the skill, the basics of fencing, so clearly that Carrie and I, with Bob and Peter's expert guidance, were able to redo the whole sequence up the steps in less than a half hour. That was the highlight of the whole film for me, because we had really learned a skill, and we were able to implement it instantly. That was quite thrilling.
We would sit there together between takes, trying to stay hydrated, wiping our faces and hands with towels, talking about what we had done right and wrong, what had worked and what hadn't worked, generally helping each other out. We'd go over the things we had been taught, holding the blade correctly, bending our knees, staying limber and loose, and so on. And most important of all, making sure that we were always looking at each other's eyes. If you look closely at the fight scene, you'll notice that Mandy and I are staring at each other throughout, telegraphing the next move or parry, actually kind of signaling to one another. We had it down to a very precise routine, so much so that the eye triggers basically became supplemental. There was no margin for error. Bob and Peter kept warning us that if we screwed up, it wasn't so much that the scene would be ruined, your partner might get hurt. But to our credit, we came out cleanly, without so much as a bump or a scratch. And with exactly the scene Rob wanted to capture on film, clocking in at approximately 3 minutes and 10 seconds. A scene that I think did justice to the way it was described on the printed page, the greatest sword fight in modern times.
Mandy Patinkin. At one point, Rob said, "I want to put the cameras all the way up to the ceiling and do a couple more takes. Are you guys up to it?" This was after we had spent several days doing these fights, and we just jumped at it like wild animals. We did the whole piece without stopping again, like a stage piece, and the only painful moments to me were every time Rob yelled, "Cut, print," because that meant we got it right, and we might not be doing that part again. That was heartbreaking to me. I just didn't want it to end.
Chapter 12, All Good Things. It's true in life, as in the movies, that the greatest highs are often followed by the lowest lows. The day after we finished shooting the sword fighting scene, I took a day to visit my ailing grandfather in the hospital. He had been diagnosed with diabetes, but it was only after I arrived that I was told that he had taken a turn for the worse. Some people barely get to know their grandparents. People take jobs in far-off places, families become fragmented, and generations occasionally lose track of each other. It happens. But I was one of those fortunate kids who grew up in close proximity to their grandparents, and I developed an especially close relationship with my grandfather. His name was Billy McLean, and he was a true adventurer, if ever